have a public hearing on Senate Bill 5517, Bureau of Labor and Industries. Today we have with us our distinguished Labor Commissioner, Mr. Dan Gardner, and with him is Annette Talbot, Deputy Labor Commissioner. Welcome. Come on up.
Oh, I'm sorry. See, they give me my scripts. please come on up.
Yeah, Satish will do the BAM analysis for us.
No.
Thanks.
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And this afternoon, there's just a few things that we wanted to discuss in the in phase two of the agency presentation. One was to discuss a little bit some of the to describe some of the major budget drivers and environmental factors that we're dealing with. I think the one thing that can't be emphasized enough from our standpoint is we have a 33% reduction in staff over the last 10 years, and that there are 247,000 more working Oregonians today than there was a decade ago. And there's certainly an increase in the complexity and numbers and complexity of laws that the agency is directed to enforce.
Okay.
One of the things clearly from some of the charts we've shown before and have with us today is the increase certainly from civil rights and the number of cases that we deal with, but yet decreases in the staff. It's rather dramatic. And to describe some of the major changes over the last 10 years, the agency has closed the service field offices in Coos Bay, Bend, and Pendleton. We've eliminated outdated programs, functions, and activities and streamlined others during the late 90s. The core programs that rely on general fund have limited resources to accomplish their goals. To give you an idea of some of the reductions, we reduced 7.51 FTE in the 2003-2005 biennium, and in 2001-2003 biennium, 15.25 FTE. The agency's cumulative effect of the reductions over time has really had an adverse impact on the agency's ability to effectively serve working Oregonians and their families. And certainly, we're going to describe some of the specific actions that the agency has.
We have a question. Representative Richardson.
Sir, how is that manifested?
I'm sorry?
You make a statement that it's had a tremendously adverse effect. How has that been manifested?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, how that's been manifested in cases taking longer periods of time to be investigated. For instance, on the civil rights side, we have up to 1 year from the time that the case has been filed in order to complete the investigation. We'd certainly like to have those done in a much quicker period of time. However, given that the reductions in staff, especially, as I said, on the civil rights side, as the FTE goes down and the caseload goes up, it is taking more time both for those types of cases, and that's really had an adverse impact on those that are complainants or employees and those that are respondents as well as employers, because it takes, you know, longer for resolution. The quicker we can resolve issues, I think the better for all parties involved.
Please, can you point me to some place where we see the graphs on the amount of time and so forth, the information showing over time how it's had a negative effect? Or if it...
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I don't have a graph of how the time has taken longer over periods of time. We don't really track in that manner within the computer system over the last 10 years, particularly with computer changes that have taken over. But we know that from talking to investigators and to the heads of the divisions that it is taking longer periods of time for that.
Okay. Follow-up?
Please.
Because I'm thinking is that, you know, since we are working on a performance-based budgeting model and your charts all show a lessening of FTEs, that's an in-house output kind of thing. It has nothing to do with the outcomes specifically. And so I look at it, I say, congratulations, you must be getting very efficient, because there's different conclusions that you can draw from the fact that you have less people than you had before. You know, maybe it's technology. Maybe it's just reorganization. There's a staffing situation. And so I'm asking, for what evidence do you have that indicate that that's a negative thing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, Annette Talbot, Deputy Labor Commissioner, for the record. We did have that conversation with the Joint Legislative Audit Committee back in August when we redid our performance measures, so we'd be glad to get you the information we presented to them. I think that people could probably reasonably disagree on at what point in the reduction did we hit efficiency and at what point did we find that there was an adverse impact to all of our customers. And I think what we would say and what we said to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee is that at this point what we find is that we did have to readjust our performance measures in order to be more realistic due to the reduction in the staff, because we did make a lot of efficiencies. The commissioner turned back cars, we moved offices, we negotiated with landlords to reduce our office space. We did quite a bit of infrastructure efficiencies last time because that was sort of the only efficiencies we could still come up with without reducing staff further and affecting our performance with our customers. So we do have an analysis of that that we gave to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. We'd be glad to share that with you. But I think that's kind of where we found ourselves in 2003, which is why we asked to have our performance measures time to readjust them. And we did that and had them unanimously approved by the Audit Committee in August to say that they were reflective of those changes that we just described. So I'd be glad to get that material to you.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. The goal is efficiency, not bulimia. And you know, we like leanness, but it's very difficult for me to be able to glean from all the data that we get where that line is. And it's you know, there's a natural trend toward those who want the money to stack the deck in presentations in favor of justifying more money, and those that would like there to be less money for whatever reason to only focus on those things that indicate that the money's being wasted or whatever. But the truth is somewhere in between, and I'm not sure how we actually can determine it. Now, you've said that you have materials mm-hmm. that can show the efficiencies. You know, those when you're cutting back your space and looking at staffing and doing those kinds of things, if you're still able to do your mandated job, then that's very positive. It's just, you know, I'd like to see, you know, how do we determine when that line's crossed and be able to rely on it, because there's a natural desire to say, you know, sky's falling, we've got to have more money or whatever. And I'm not saying that you guys are, but, you know, we've gone through a lot of budgets. And so it's just an interesting dynamics.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, as one who sat on both your side of the table and this side of the table, I certainly understand that dynamic. And I certainly do believe there are places and areas we can do more with less in government as a whole. I think the point I'm trying to say is that the number one complaint I get as the head of an agency from both employers and employees is the time that it takes to get through investigations, and part of that has to do with the reductions that have been happening. We can do more with less to a certain degree, but there is a breaking point there somewhere where you just absolutely can't.
I'm going to digress very quickly. Can you share with me? I missed the round one presentation. I was somewhere. Who's the customer?
Mr. Chair, as far as I'm concerned, you know, government as a whole, my philosophy has always been that we are a customer service oriented, and the customer to me is both the complainant and the respondent. My goal is, and we're starting to do that, we're starting to go ahead and look at one of our performance measures with...
I'm sorry, let me, I want to digress it even further. Your customer is...
Anyone who calls or comes through the door. As far as that makes a complaint or someone who is complained about.
Relating to
civil rights, wage and hour. On the apprenticeship side, the customer is the Joint Apprenticeship and Training Councils, as well as the apprentices that we work in overseeing the training for. It depends on which one of the divisions, but it's always those that we deal with in those areas.
So do you serve... By title, it's labor and industry. So you serve on behalf of labor and on behalf of industry.
Mr. Chair, yes. I mean, the title is labor and industries, which was changed in 1989 from the Bureau of Labor to the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Well, while, if I could explain a little bit, I mean, there's different divisions, and you look at it different ways with each division. With the wage and hour in the civil rights division, for instance, the complainant is, you know, always an employee. No employer files civil rights or wage and hour complaints against an employee. It just doesn't work that way. Those, in those cases, what our goal is, and as I was saying, one of our performance reviews is that of customer service survey. You can't ask someone, though, what the outcome, whether they liked it or not, unless your, you know, your performance measure goal is 50%, because you've got winners and losers. But our goal is, from a customer service standpoint, that both the employer and employee, the complainant or respondent, knew every step of the process, knew what the next step was, felt that their issues were being heard, and that we approached it from a fair and balanced standpoint as an independent agency that's looking at it independently to see what are the facts in the case. For instance, from the civil rights side, although we have a number of complaints every year, only 10% are ever found for cause. To actually that have,
is, I didn't want to.
Okay,
I'm sorry. I just wanted to, I'm just trying to figure out who the customer is. So,
Mr. Chair, if I might, since you weren't able to hear our overview, on page 3 of our book, under the first tab, said agency overview, we have listed what we believe are the investments that you make when you invest in tax dollars in the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And I think they go over the variety of customers that we have, which include employers. As the manager of the technical assistance unit for employers, I want to make sure that we mention that we actually have a specific unit that's dedicated just to employers, as our customer advises them about how to comply with the law, and is actually not in any way funded by general fund dollars. It's self-supporting by the publication of our books, our posters, and our seminars. So while we serve employers in that capacity as well, and in addition, I think we serve employers through providing a neutral law enforcement arena where they can have their complaints related to their employees settled in a way that doesn't involve the judiciary and all the litigation, and is a more efficient way of addressing issues and resolving them, so their workplace can kind of get back in working order and not have these complaints and workplace disputes interrupt their ability to do business.
You survey them after...
We absolutely do. All of our business folks that come to our seminars, we have a survey, and it's a 1-5 scale, and we have over a 4.5 rating on all of our seminars, so we get a very high rating on our seminars.
Do you survey, though, the dispute resolution that occurs?
We do not now. That is one of our developmental performance measures that the Progress Board is working on developing, a customer service survey, and we have decided to wait for them to complete that so that our survey will match the rest of the survey that the rest of the state is using. And we are in the same boat as a bunch of other agencies that resolve disputes, is that you have to differentiate at the end of the day that you didn't like the outcome versus you thought the process was fair. So our questions are going to be important as how you phrase that. It's a little tricky.
Yeah.
As Commissioner says, you pretty much have a winner and a loser and in every case. So.
And one other division, Mr. Chair, to mention, of course, is the Apprenticeship and Training Division. And, of course, those are made up of joint apprenticeship and training committees, both labor and management, working cooperatively together to support workforce development training predominantly in the construction and building trades to address workforce shortages, which, by the way, I hate to admit it, but I have been admitting lately that I am the average age of a construction worker at 46 years of age, and we've got a heck of a shortage facing us in the next 7 to 8 years. So we're working very heavily in that division, both with labor and management, to, you know, make sure that we have those young people trained and ready for the workforce.
Senator Carter.
I just want to tell you, the reason we're dribbling in, because we didn't get out of session until 12:45.
I apologize, Senator Bird.
No, that's all right. I was just going to say that one of the things that I presume that you get a lot of is just people using you as a resource, because when I was a mayor and the cities looked that they can call you at any time and ask you for any kind of question, so you're on the top of their list as a resource. And I would presume that it takes up somebody's time.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, clearly it does, and we, you know, we value all of those agencies out there or independent businesses, and we try to be that resource to them and help them in any way, shape, or form we can. We even put on, as Ms. Talbot was saying a little while ago, you know, we answer 25,000 phone calls a year from employers to help them and, you know, in making sure that they're, you know, they don't fall into making mistakes in any way with their business. And we put on seminars all over the state to try to assist in that area as well. One quick story I could tell you is when I was running for labor commissioner, I remember being in LeGrand meeting with a vice president of a bank, and I was talking to her about the technical assistance unit. She says, oh, I actually went to one of those seminars. And she says, you know, at one of them, the subject of final paychecks came up, and a woman popped up, asked 6 or 8 poignant questions, then excused herself and said she had to go straighten something out. Mm-hmm. And what the individual giving the seminar said, well, wait a minute, here's where you call if you got any more questions. Here's, and, you know, we try to be that resource to help out, and there is absolutely a firewall between our technical assistance unit and the enforcement side so that, you know, none of that ever comes over one side or the other. We're just there to really try to get employers into compliance under the law if there's any problems and make sure those problems are alleviated, if we can, through the training seminars that we put on.
Mr. Chair, I think my point was to make that a lot of people think in terms of labor and industry as being a totally different thing from counties and cities.
Mm-hmm.
But counties and cities are employers, and so these people are their resource that they go to when they have to settle settle things for themselves.
Well, we're only 24 minutes into this, and you're going to get the lecture that everyone else gets on small business. So buck up and take it for about 3 minutes here. one of the issues I'm absolutely convinced of is that if we want to jumpstart the state's economy, we need to help small business owners in hiring their first employee. And you folks play a key role in folks learning how to hire that first employee. And several members on this committee have heard me over and over talk to all the other key participants, which include Department of Revenue, Consumer and Business Services, Department of Administrative Services because of some of the technical assistance they provide, and now you folks. And this is a partnership. You're a statewide elected official, and what I would ask as chair of this committee is that you would work with us in trying to create a system in the interim that makes it as simple and as educational, if you will, for mom and pop out there who want to hire employee number one to learn how to do it. Because I'm absolutely convinced they don't know how to do it. It's a very scary thing for doing it, and they're worried about you in terms of, if I mess up, I've got the Department of Revenue and I've got the Bureau of Labor and Industries I've got to face. And I would love to take what you're doing and change the paradigm, if you will, from Bureau of Labor and Industry is the people who are going to keep me from hiring the employee to those are the people who can help me get it done. And so I would ask that you would work with us on that and you'll be receiving a phone call if you agree to help us with an interim project to make that work.
Mr. Chair, if I might, we had an interim task force over last biennium that on the issue of independent contractors and that definition in employment. One of the things that came up, and we participated in that, one of the things that came up very clearly was that while all those agencies do separate training on that, those kinds of places, and we do some global training, that there was no one training for that business who hires their first employee.
Stop. We need to make a note here because we're going to be putting that on my web page. You're exactly right.
We have separate trainings. A new employer could go to our civil rights training. They could go to our wage and hour training.
That's
they
right.
could go to our, you know, individual topical trainings. But what we committed to do with Department of Revenue and Employment Department, probably CCB, Construction Contractors Board, other agencies that deal with employers, is to say what are the things that trigger in that first hiring the first employee, because it's too hard for a new business person, having, you know, had a small business myself, it's hard enough to get your billing out and do your work, let alone try to figure out how many seminars you're going to go to try and learn everything you need to learn. So if you could go to one place and in a few hours kind of have a really good broad brush of here's all the things to make sure you know about, because what you don't know and you don't know is what usually hurts you in the law. So we're more than willing to commit to that and help, and our trainers are great trainers. Like I say, they get very good reviews from the people who come to their seminars. So the more that we can work with those other agencies to develop such a training, the Secretary of State's Corporations Division and their business guide also should be in that mix.
So you know, what we're trying to do is in the interim is to create a one-stop online process. If any of you have ever looked at TurboTax, mm-hmm. where they ask you questions,
mm-hmm.
you type in the answer, then you hit enter and you go to question number two. We want to set that system up, and so that way when an entrepreneur's done, they push the button, and they've now legally have taken all the steps they need to create and to know about right. employee number one.
And we don't have as the Bureau, no one has to register with us in any way like they do with DCBS or employment for their unemployment insurance cash rolls. So we're sort of not necessarily in that upfront registration loop, but they definitely do need to know the employment laws, and perfect. That's what our technical assistance unit is there for.
My last point, and then we'll move forward, is for stimulating this economy. There is no greater thing we can do than that one step. And I'm just waiting for the statewide elected official that runs with that, because they'll do more for the state's economy than any other action of this entire committee. So, Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Listening to this exchange, it occurs to me that if we're going to work on this in the interim to try to get some consolidated one-stop shopping, that it might be nice to have, whether it's in a computer program or a handout, a checklist. And that a potential entrepreneur walks in to every one of the portals by which they could enter, Secretary of State, you guys, DCBS, and they leave with a standardized State of Oregon form that these are the things you need to consider before you hire your first employee, and on one side the checklist, and on the other the agencies or the website or whatever other information we might develop.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I couldn't agree with you more. The more we can make it easier and streamlined so that it's not that, you know, cumbersome to the person to get that first employee started, the more those companies can end up growing and end up not with just one employee, but with more. And,
right.
And the, you know, we're fully committed to helping in that in any way, shape, or form that we can. I think also one thing that, you know, unfortunately the message that gets out to employers is not the real message, is that we're not the big bad enforcement agency. If you look at the wage and hour side, for instance, our goal is to get the employer in compliance under the law, not to fine the heck out of them. And we don't fine anybody for a first-time mistake or error. You know, even on meals and rest periods, it's you get three violations in a one-year period, then we'll start looking at it. But, you know, you get a couple of free strikes at it. Let's just help you get in compliance before we'd ever get there.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I think that this exchange and such a little checklist or something would achieve two goals. One that the commissioner has already touched on, to make it less daunting and less frightening for the first-time employer. But the other thing, to have a standardized with the state imprimatur on it that says we're open for business. Our goal as a state, and it is a policy of the state, and we all have this same look and feel about our materials that are set out to help entrepreneurs. We're open for business. We want to help you succeed, and you got the state of Oregon watching your back.
That's right.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I couldn't agree with you more. There are no employees out there if they're not employers willing to take that risk, that gamble, to build and grow a business.
Yeah.
And we need to be very, very well aware of that and make sure we do everything to help that, because if we're in favor of, you know, family wage jobs and making sure there are more employment out there, you absolutely have to have more employers. There's just no doubt about it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
I have a question. Dan, do you sit on the board of the Oregon Economic Development Commission?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, no, I do not. I've actually put in a bill for the last two sessions to be put on the Economic Development Commission. It's my personal belief that part of what would help in this process The Oregon Economic Development Commission is made up of six people, all from a business background, but there isn't anyone from like a workforce development standpoint, or like in Bowley's case, from an apprenticeship standpoint.
That's part
of the workforce development. I think that there are ways we could coordinate better, and it probably is of great benefit to add someone from workforce and someone from Bowley from the apprenticeship side to that. I've had a bill in to do that for two sessions, and we did get a hearing this session, but it's not out yet.
But you have a bill in this session?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, yes, I do, on the Senate side.
Okay.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I just want to offer my apologies to the panel. I have to go scoot and testify on the bill. I'll be right back.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, if I could continue just a little bit, there's just a few other comments we wanted to make, talking a little bit about some of the specific actions that we've taken to contain costs and improve program delivery. Annette touched on a few of them, like our reducing the rent here in our current Salem office where our farm labor unit is out on Lancaster. We relocated the Medford office. We used to have our own standalone office. We now have four cubicles in with the employment department where we use their conference rooms and greatly reduced our rent there as well. We also reduced one of the things in the Portland office that we did. I noticed that we had almost all but a little sliver of the 10th floor and a quarter of the 11th floor, but we had four reception areas, one for wage and hour, one for civil rights, one for apprenticeship, and one for the commissioner's office. And my concept was, why can't we reduce that down to one reception area and thereby, and also take over that little sliver of governor space. And we took over all of the 10th floor and got everyone off of the 11th floor, saving us actually $105,000 out of the general fund. We also reduced the agency's motor pool up to and including the commissioner's car. I drive my own vehicle. I don't need a state car, thank you very much. And also reduced some of the telecommunication line and expenditures there as well. But part of that also was trying to improve customer service along the way. We also do, we haven't been able to put enough reception staff to actually answer every phone call, but if you dial the main number and press zero, you will get a live person. Our goal also is to return every single phone call within 24 hours. We also had all of the employees change their voicemail. Rather than having a generic voicemail that may be, hi, this is so-and-so, they change it every single day, letting you know what hours they're going to be in the office, how soon you could expect a return phone call. If they're out on vacation, that's on the voicemail, and here's who you should call. Because, to me, I really do believe in customer service. I believe in letting everyone know every step you humanly possibly could. Some of our people work 410s, for instance. I wouldn't want someone calling in on a Friday expecting a return phone call from someone who works Monday through Thursday. It says that on their voicemail so that everyone knows, you know, when they can anticipate return calls.
Senator Carter.
Thank you. Commissioner, can you tell me the differential in terms of cost as it relates to your giving up your state car? How much of the savings there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I think Annette might know what the monthly charge is for that. All I do charge for is when I go out of the... I'm based in Portland. I go out of the area, I charge... I get the standard per-mile fee. I do not charge anything for any in the Tri-County area travel and everywhere.
I was more concerned about your insurance because it would appear to me that with you being an employee of the state, that your protection, if anything happened to you, even during the work time, that your cost, personal cost, is going to go up in terms of insurance, or if you, God forbid, have a deadly accident and you're in your own car as opposed to the state car, what kind of protection do you have? Now, I know you want to help the state out by not having a state car, but I think you need to think about, you know, your own detriment or your benefits. And I know with you getting married pretty soon, your wife's going to have more sense to see about that. But I'm just wondering if you might share that with us.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I don't know that I've ever looked at it as a statewide elected official. You are technically considered on the job 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from a legal standpoint. I find that rather than, taking on that burden myself is actually more of a convenience to me in some ways, because some of the DAS policies on the state car really are rather cumbersome. For instance, if I were to leave a hearing today and pick up my children at their mother's house tonight, I could not do that in a state car. I would have to go transfer to my own personal car because they're not state employees.
Right.
At one point, I lived out near the Gresham area, for instance. If you left a committee hearing from last legislative session, a reasonable person could take that car home, but you then could not go to Fred Meyer's for groceries under the DAS rules. So I found them rather, unless I wanted to have a vehicle at the office and one at home to be able to switch out and do different things with, some of the DAS rules around it are rather burdensome, and I find it just easier and more convenient for myself to drive my own.
Well, just think about your own safety and protection.
I'm ready
Thank
to put
you,
life insurance on him. Protect the state's interest.
I hate to see what the rate would be based on what I do.
When you take out your car insurance, they ask you if you use it in your business, and you say yes, and they adjust the premium accordingly, but then you have as much coverage as you want to buy.
That's true.
Mr. Chair, if I might, the commissioner is going over all of the efficiencies that we have worked on in the last several years. If you take a look at the agency tab again on page agency overview, page 13, there is a summary of all of those, and it also shows that in combination of cutting the vehicle fleet, streamlining the operations in Salmon, Medford, working on our telecommunications services and some other things, all told, that we were able to save a $242,000 in general fund savings in all of those things. Obviously, those dollars then are not needed in upcoming bienniums as well. So it's not just a direct savings in one biennium. It's avoidance of those costs as we go forward as well. So I think they're all laid out there fairly well. If you have any questions in addition to what we've laid out there, we can certainly address them.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, would you like the budget analyst to go now? I'm not sure if we got out of order with that. Or
you know what? What I would like to do is, and I haven't shared this with Robin, and she'll probably kick me here under here. This committee prioritized the budget, and I'm curious what your response is to how we prioritized your budget.
I could take a minute and get the priority list out.
Well, Mr. Chair, I know the one thing that we noticed that was, that I had some qualms about as far as the priority list. One was the farm labor unit being ranked. So I think part of that is there's, additional information we could certainly provide about the farm labor unit and what it does. Certainly at, works to eliminating that function would interfere with the ability to assure an adequate workforce for the agriculture industry. We license farm labor camps, farm labor contractors, and farm and forest contractors. One of the things most people aren't aware of is that, for all the forest fires across the entire country, between Oregon and Washington, we train over 90% of those forest firefighters. And most of them are trained right here in Oregon or in our next-door neighbor in Washington. And we license those, those entities that hire those forest firefighters. We do is...
So would the function go away, or would your ability to oversee them go away?
Both. The function would go away and our ability to oversee them. We license them. No one else would take over that licensing of forest firefighting companies, of farm labor contractors, of farm labor camps,
So who requires the license? I need a little 101 here. The state of Oregon requires that, or the federal government requires?
The state of Oregon requires it through the Bureau of Labor and Industries.
A little bit of a predicament there.
Given that we may be, Mr. Chair, going into one of the difficult, trying forest firefighting season, eliminating that function, we believe, would have some serious issues in terms of the worker safety, in terms of the crew as a whole, in terms of the communities that, you know, rely on those firefighters to be well-trained so their houses and forests don't burn down. So it is a vital function, and we're not sure that we were conveyed that in the first hearing well enough. But, so that was the one priority list piece that caused us a little bit of a heartburn. But otherwise, I think, you know, there was nothing else that came out below, too much below that.
And the other thing I might say, Mr. Chair, is we work in a very cooperative fashion with the federal government, with all other agencies that have anything to do with with forest firefighting as well. And as you can recall, there are some problems in that area and recent accidents that happened in the past few years. And we want to make sure that those forest firefighters are clearly trained adequately.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Senator Carter.
As long as I've been here, even I did not know Boley did the training of force, you know, the firefighters.
We don't do the actual, Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, we don't do the actual training. We oversee and license those companies who do provide that training and hire those particular firefighters.
Well, and then I'm glad you're really telling me that now, because I've been concerned about how we don't have drivers other than the firefighters themselves, and why we've been having so many accidents without having a person who is not a firefighter or having to go into work on that, to have drivers that are separate from those that are fighting the fires. I think this makes all kind of sense. And so I know, so when I filled mine out, I probably was not cognizant of that at all. And certainly we want your oversight to be great among these things, because I'm concerned about so many of our young people that have been killed, not only fighting the fires themselves, but the accidents.
Yeah.
And we brought this up in the committee negotiations about how can we have somebody that is a driver that is not one of the firefighters, other than the firefighter, because I really do believe that sleep and other decisions have a lot, lack of sleep thereof, have a lot to do with why so many accidents.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I couldn't agree with you more that lack of sleep does. They work some long, hard hours when they're on the line, and they should not, you know, be then jumping in a car and driving a number of hours from whatever state back to Oregon.
So, Mr. Commissioner, I'm putting that in your hands. We can feel reasonably sure that that would be one of the questions that you ask them in terms of changes or requesting something different to take place.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, Christy Hammond with our Wage and Hour Division does work cooperatively with the federal government agencies and with the other state agencies that have any oversight, and they are very heavily looking into that area and trying to make some changes.
Good.
She could probably tell you a little bit more about it than I could.
Okay. I believe she might have some information that would be helpful.
Thank you.
Well, Chair Smith and Representative, or Senator Carter, excuse me, I'm Christy Hammond, the Director of the Wage and Hour Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Part of the licensing process does require that contractors demonstrate to us that their vehicles are licensed and registered, and that they have adequate vehicle insurance. That's part of our licensing process. We don't directly regulate who drives the vehicles. However, I was telling Ms. Talbot that there are maximum hours that firefighters may work as a part of the contract that the contractors enter into. And if those contractors allowed their employees to exceed those numbers of hours worked and drive and were to violate the law, we would have regulatory authority over those contractors. We could assess civil penalties against contractors who violate the law, and we can also revoke their right to act as farm labor, as contractors.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chairman, I think that that's a very serious issue. And so what it sounds like to me is that it's kind of lost between the owners of the company and their decision to, and I know that the bottom line is saving dollars, but at the same time, young people lives, our young people are already endangering their lives by fighting, and then to add the added pressure of who's going to drive, I want to see some sightseeing, I want to have some fun, and responsibility of driver becomes something else. So I don't know how we get at that. Hopefully some pressure we got by the federal government on companies to have somebody to drive other than the workers themselves.
Maybe that's an issue we can work through between now and round three, because there's another component to that. And you know, part of the motivation of those long hours is that's where a lot of folks earn their money.
Yes.
And they work like, well, I'm from Eastern Oregon, they work like dogs.
Yes.
For
and I can
six
see them
to
extending
weeks.
Their hours at time. You
right.
know?
So let's find the balance there. And maybe between now and round three, let's find the balance between.
I believe there are limitations on the hours they work, and we can get that information
Perfect.
To you.
Perfect. Because there's two valid issues we need to deal with here.
We'll get the information to you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. But it sounds like it's statutory already.
I think the Department of Forestry has regulations that apply.
Okay, the U.S. Department of Forestry.
In contract with the State Department of Forestry.
All right.
We actually have a quarterly meeting where we sit down with the U.S. Forest Service, Department of Forest Service, OSHA, ourselves, and farm labor folks to have these kind of conversations. What are the latest issues? What do we need to do as a group to figure out how to do them? You know, develop some policy. Is there legislation needed? That kind of thing. So we do routinely have that conversation, but we'll be glad to circle back around with Department of Forestry and the U.S. Department of Forestry to see where they have or don't have sort of policies or regulations on that number of
values. Is there a way to separate out ag from timber? Because really those are two very, very different industries with two very, very different issues. It's easy to lump the two together and say it's a hourly work. I'm sorry, I don't know the terminology. Yeah, but that's not the issue. They're very different in their objectives and what's going on, and I think somehow we need to separate those out.
Mr. Chair,
to address both the issues separately.
We certainly will. I only lump them together because actually some contractors do both work. They do farm labor contractor work,
oh.
And then they also employ forest fire crews at various different seasons of the year. So when we talk about them together, although we know there's isolated issues in each.
But the rules for both are separate.
Correct.
Got it. Thank you. Thank you. That's helpful.
Senator Berger? Mr. Chair, one of the things that I'm so interested in is job creation. And I think I'd really like to address a little bit about the apprenticeship and training, because it seems to me that I'm not sure that we have that focused enough, maybe within this particular department.
Okay.
And I'd like to pursue that just a little bit with you, Dan. Do you feel like your apprenticeship and training program is right where you want it to be? In other words, is it top shelf? And if not, what does it take to get it there?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, I believe that the apprenticeship and training committees that are out there are top shelf. I know that a number of years ago, there was a situation with apprenticeship and training committees where they were technically state agencies, and basically how it worked was that they were, as state agencies, they had attorney general's access in order for attorney general's opinions. They also had situations where if the training committee was not operating properly, Bowie would send in staff in order to run the program for them. And working with Commissioner Roberts when I was on the other side of the dais there, we actually stopped them from having agency status and believed that apprenticeship and training committees should rise or fall on their own. We passed legislation, I believe it was in 1997, to do that and to make sure that they did. A number of committees did reduce. The committees that are still there are those doing unbelievably absolutely excellent training. Part of the problem, though, is what can we do to help those committees to deal with the workforce shortage that we're facing? As I said earlier, the average age of a construction worker is 46 years of age. And I think that, you know, that greatly needs to be reduced if we're going to affect having enough workforce in the future. And that's part of what we're concentrating on, and some of the things we're concentrating on it with are doing things like Senate Bill 150 that passed the Senate the other day, saying that in public works projects over a certain dollar figure, which in that particular bill is $350,000, that they actually end up on for general contractors having to get training agent status. Doesn't say they've got to have apprentices. Doesn't say how many apprentices they have to have. But it gets them to the door with those training committees so that they can then educate any contractor that, for instance, comes into the state from out of state to do a state contract to know how apprentices are available, where they're available. We're doing other projects and working with OTIA 3 on making sure that on the highway projects that we are trying to push the training committees a little bit on those to bring more access and use of apprentices in training on those programs. We're also doing a number of things in with the Department of Education. For instance, one of the things, if you look at the cutbacks in K-12 education over the last several years, one of the first things that seems to go in a lot of communities is the voc tech programs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are a few exceptions to that with training centers that are out there in Benson High School, but Benson High School in Portland, for instance, is not nearly adequate enough for the population of the student population to address voc tech for the entire area. And many of the more rural communities just have dropped voc tech entirely. What we're trying to do, we've got 54 apprenticeship and training centers across the state for the various different crafts. Most of those training centers are empty during the day. And why can't we work a partnership? We're trying to do two pilot projects, one rural, one urban, an opening by September, where we bring those training facilities together with the school district and work on donations from the various different suppliers out there to bring materials in to try and set up that partnership where we can recreate not all of the voc tech, but some of the voc tech programs. We're working on a number of programs like that to address those apprenticeship and training shortages, but the shortage is really the largest problem, not the training that's out there now. I believe the training that's out there now is perfectly adequate. The number of committees that we have, they do a phenomenal job. And we do performance reviews on them either every year to every 5 years, depending on their graduation rate. If you've got a graduation rate of 70% or above, it's once every 5 years.
We follow up, Mr. Chair. We're running into that with long-haul truck drivers. We had the biggest cranberry season we've ever had on the coast, and we had trucks sitting with no drivers because we couldn't move it to market. So but those are gaps that are so serious, because here we have the product, here we have the market for the product, but we don't have the qualified people, and the age is exactly where what you're talking about. Young people don't want to be gone from home, or they're not drawn and attracted to truck driving, long-haul truck driving. So, but those gaps, if we can fill a lot of those gaps, we might be able to take care of some of our job creation and unemployment.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, I couldn't agree with you more, and we're trying to do things to address it with long-haul truckers. Part of the problem is you have to be, if I remember correctly, it's over about 23 or 24 years of age in order to get the insurance, right, for the program, where you may be legally available to have the position as far as licensing and being able to get the license. Insurance tends to be part of the problem with age in that particular profession.
And Mr. Chair, there's not enough training for them. In fact, Thomas & Sons in Coos Bay offered to establish training there at their business for it. So that's what I was told. So I'm not real sure about that, but when we questioned it, because I was very concerned, you know, for one thing, you have produce that you can't leave it around for a long time. It has to be moved. And so
let me take the apprenticeship program and go 35 years ahead on that. And is there a statutory reason why journeymen professionals, whether they come out of the plumbing or electrical field, can't start their own small business and retain their pension?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of any reason that they couldn't retain their pension. You know, it depends. When you look at those different programs and you look at the different professions, you always have to look at the union side or the open shop side, and there's a difference between the two as far as they set, how they set up retirement plans and things of that nature. The easier side for me certainly is the union side, and that I know if you are part of the collective bargaining agreement and you've been a journeyman and you've earned a pension and then you become a contractor, you can still be a member of the same trust for retirement. There's no problem whatsoever with that.
And I apologize, I'm getting into some very specifics. I had an individual who put in 40 years, wanted to start their own small little plumbing business, and was informed that they would not be able to start that as a condition of their retirement out of the hall. I don't want Jared Broadfoot coming to my office and moving in for the next 3 weeks. I'm just asking a question.
Mr. Chair, I would have to look into the individual program, you know, to be able
to
answer
those. There's not statutory.
There's no statutory. No, those are trusts that are set up through federal law, and there are specific set-aside trusts. And what rules and conditions the trustees put on that,
got it.
Can vary, but they have to follow federal law. There's not state law on those.
Thank you. Look, can we talk about the Civil Rights Division?
Certainly we can talk about the Civil Rights Division.
I'm kind of bouncing around on you here.
Okay.
I've actually got a couple questions here.
Sure.
One of the other prevailing messages of this committee is that every Oregonian has a right, should have an opportunity to do business and to work in the state of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm curious about is what steps need to be taken to make sure that the three different divisions of women, minority and emerging small business that exist in consumer and business services, in economic development, and in the governor's office are coordinated with you folks. Those are three groups that are serving as advocates,
mm-hmm,
to ensure equal opportunity. And I want to make sure, you know, when we pass your budget, that I feel good knowing that you folks are coordinated with what they're doing.
Well, Mr. Chair, actually, you know, from our standpoint, we are a complaint-driven agency, and what we do through the Civil Rights Division is when there is a complaint of violation of civil rights, we really, with the reduction in staff, as you might point out in the middle chart there, as I keep saying, there's the increase in cases and the decrease in staff, we don't do any outreach anymore. What we do is deal with the complaints that come in, assess whether there is cause or not in those complaints. If you find for cause, what we often do is go to conciliation hearings and try to work it out between the employer and employee. If it can't be, then it can go on into an administrative process, or the individual complainant can get a right to sue letter and take it to court. But we don't actually do anything through the Civil Rights Division other than investigations of complaints of violation of civil rights.
Mr. Chair, if I might, we do, however, do outreach to a variety of groups like the Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs. We just actually appeared there 2 weeks ago at a breakfast meeting to talk to them about, introduce them. All of our staff came, introduced them to the staff, said, you know, here's our technical assistance unit, here's the services we provide for free, here's the things that you have, small fees for seminars. So we make sure that they're aware of our services, and we talk a lot to them. At that point, we were talking to them predominantly about apprenticeship, because they have training needs too.
Oh, yeah.
Even when they,
uh-huh,
only have two or three staff, how do they go about training? How do they go about getting information on prevailing wage rate law if they want to try and get jobs on public works contracts? We have free training for prevailing wage rate contractors who are interested in how do they get their foot in the door. So on those things, we actually do have that kind of links with women, minority, and emerging small businesses. How do they get their foot in the door with apprenticeship? How do they get their foot in the door on public contracts? And as I said, we offer all those trainings as well for folks. So we don't have direct linkage with them, but we do a lot of projects with them that are sort of that kind of training, making sure that employers know how to access the services. And we've been, like on Senate Bill 150, the commissioner mentioned about apprenticeship and training. We were very cognizant of that when we work with AGC. And Jessica, I think, is still in the back of the room here to talk about our prevailing wage rate package. But we were cognizant of the fact that if you tie training too closely to public contracts, you won't be able to get those women and minorities and small businesses in there if you make it too burdensome for them. So we took out the subcontractors out of that bill and are committed to work with the Minority Entrepreneurs Group and AGC and others to make sure that we find ways to get them training available. I do believe, to Senator Verger's point earlier about workforce training, too, is that I used to be a workforce policy analyst for the prior governor, and workforce policy issues, we try to work with the community colleges and workforce development, Department of Education.
Do you have folks who are fluent in Spanish?
We do.
Many.
HR, absolutely.
Spanish, Russian, and two or three other languages, I recall.
One of the things we're going to be trying to do in the interim, perhaps, have enough wishy-washy language there, is trying to figure out how to strengthen women, minorities, and emerging small business. And I'm hoping you folks will come to the table and work with us on that issue. Morrow County, where I come from, in the northern half, it's 62% Hispanic. And they have just as much right to do business and to be employed in Morrow County as anyone else, and I want to make sure that we're doing all we can to ensure that.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. In all of our publications, we try to make sure that they're all bilingual. And what I was trying to say earlier is really it's not through the Civil Rights Division that we do outreach. It's more through the Apprenticeship and Training Division and the Technical Assistance side.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Berger.
It seems to me that the question is, and I'd be curious to know if maybe Annette might have the answer to this, but are we getting better at being more respectful of other people's civil rights, or are we getting worse at it? Because I think your complaints and phone calls or letters would tell us that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, at least in the recent past, the number of complaints have not changed dramatically. They may vary from about 2,100 one year to 2,200, 2,300 the next year, but we don't seem to have a great variation in the actual number. The types of complaints have changed over time, certainly, and the nature of the complaints have changed because civil rights laws have been in effect since 1964. So people have a better sense of that, I believe. One thing that I know this commissioner has talked to myself and Ms. Claire, who's the Civil Rights Division Administrator, is how do we do more outreach to community groups, churches, and others who are interested in making sure civil rights laws are enforced and respected and people are educated about them. And we continue to try to find ways to do that. Certainly, Senate Bill 706 that Senator Carter is sponsoring on housing discrimination is another way where we can educate the population about discrimination generally. It's a hard nut to crack. I guess I would also say, and I know Ms. Claire would say if you brought her up there, is that we are responsible to take any complaint that comes in the door about civil rights. And as you might expect, they're not always meritorious. So we weed through a lot of things to find out where there really is something that may be unlawful. We are a neutral law enforcement agency in that respect. We don't advocate for one party or the other until we see that there's been a violation. And we are complaint-based, so we aren't able to go out and, you know, have conversations with people about how are things going. We wait for someone to bring something in the door.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Annette, is there a reoccurring theme? Is there an area where, particularly out of those 2,200 complaints, you're seeing a pattern?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the reoccurring complaint is that sexual discrimination, sexual harassment still is about one out of five of our cases. represents that. So that is, you know, a little unsettling that that hasn't improved since the issue of gender discrimination has been pretty widely discussed and litigated for quite a few years now. About 20% are disability discrimination. That is a field that has, the amount of complaints has grown as we've tried to accommodate more people with disabilities into the workforce. I think that is probably reasonable to expect you'd have more disagreements about how do you do that.
Follow-up, Senator Johnson.
How elastic is the definition in Oregon of disability? What all does it encompass?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, our law in a large respect mirrors the federal ADA law. So it, you know, you have to have a substantial major life activity that is your disability limits and impairs a major life activity. And then your employer has an obligation to reasonably accommodate that. So it's very similar to the ADA in all substantive ways. It does cover a different set of employers. It covers employers with 6 or more employees, and the federal law starts at 15. So that's the main difference.
Thank you.
Senator Carter.
Mr. Commissioner, in speaking to your group, not your group, but the federal group last year, and they were so excited about housing discrimination that you'll be glad to know that Senate Bill 706 did pass the Senate floor this morning.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, thank you very much. I heard you got 23 aye votes, and appreciate your supporting that bill and sponsoring it and your work on the bill.
Yeah.
It'd be good to have those cases coming back into the state of Oregon instead of being done in Seattle.
That's right. Exactly.
Other questions? David, please continue.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I believe Satish was going to...
Oh, I can talk for you.
We do have some policy option packages that we, I think, if this is an appropriate time to talk about them, we also have an individual here, Jessica, from AGC, to speak to one of our policy option packages and their support for that. So, Mr. Chair, is this an appropriate time for that?
Okay, that'd be fine.
You want to talk about the
package? Actually, there's a couple of packages. One was to provide technical assistance to employees to is funded with fees, and that particular position, technical assistance is totally a fee-driven side of the agency. We have one position that's part of that policy option package for technical assistance, only if we can, you know, obviously raise the funds within our seminars, the sales of our books, etc., in order to fund that particular position. There is two positions that we were talking about. One actually that's actually in the package, one that's a conversion for the prevailing wage unit. The prevailing wage unit is funded through fees that come in off of every prevailing wage project. This is totally an other funded package and would encompass two more investigators. We've seen a dramatic increase in this particular side, and not only an increase, but an increase in the time it takes for an investigation. One of the ones I use as an example particularly is the Coos Bay Pipeline project, where it involved over 400 employees that had to be through that particular investigation. That ties up an entire investigator. One of the things we find is that when we do one of those investigations, we attach the bond of the general contractor. And as Jessica will tell you, you know, that ties up their bonding capacity. The quicker we can get those investigations done, the much better for the contractor, for the employee, for everyone involved. And by having those two additional positions, which are totally other funded, that would help us with those increased investigations, or the expediency of those investigations.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Mr. Commissioner, what's the life of the investigation now? I'm sure you told us in the earlier presentation. I just don't remember.
Actually, to be completely accurate, I better bring the life of the investigation of that particular project, you mean? Or?
No, not that particular. You're asking for these two additional positions, and it will shorten the time with these additional positions from 6 million weeks to 1 week.
Well, definitely be under 6 million weeks. Actually, I think really what it's... Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, what it should do is help to reduce the time frame on investigations, I would hope, by approximately a third.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors. We're here to testify in support of the addition of these folks for investigation of prevailing wage claims. Commissioner Gardner has correctly identified the problem. For contractors, I mean, there are a wide range of claims. There are the big Coos Bay pipeline claims, and those are just enormous and are always going to take a long time because they involve so many people. And then you have claims that deal with three or four employees, and really if those could just be resolved quickly, it gets the employees paid if they indeed are entitled to compensation, and it gets the contractor on their way. The general contractor is generally the one on the hook, even if it may be a subcontractor who has caused the problem and not paid their employees. So for a general contractor, it really is a hardship. Most of the contractors in the state of Oregon are small, less than 25 employees. So these are homegrown family businesses whose bonding capacity is tied up, which prevents them from getting another public works job. So if you don't have, you only get so much bonding capacity depending on your credit rating and the amount of work you do. So getting these claims moved along quickly is very much in our interest. So that we can get back to work and resolve these disputes quickly. It's our understanding that the department hits their performance target of 90 days to complete these claims about 39% of the time. We would really like to see that number push 70 or 80%, because that would mean that these small claims just get moved right along and dealt with. It's our understanding the average size of a claim is about $12,000. You add liquidated damages onto that, it's about $30,000 that contractors deal with on an average basis. Those in the grand scope of a construction project are very small, but when you hold a bond, you hold the entire bond, not just necessarily that small part.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could further answer just a little bit more of Senator Johnson's question. He was talking about the reduction in the time it takes. There's also another bill that AGC and Boley are working together on Senate Bill 477. It's not on the Senate floor yet, so I can put the plug in. But anyway, it's on its way. The other piece that helps to speed up investigations is our ability to get the certified payrolls quicker. Part of our problem in investigations is that when we find a complaint, we find it is a public works project, then it takes a period of time to get those certified payrolls. So AGC and Boley are working together to reduce, to make sure that what that bill will say is that if the contracting agency, whether it be Department of Human Services or ODOT or whoever the contracting agency is, that they'll withhold part of the payment to that contractor, 25%, which actually would represent the wages, until the certified payrolls are into the contracting agency. By getting those certified payrolls, clearly they're going to want their 25%. They're going to be quicker about getting the certified payrolls to the contracting agency, which then gets us the certified payrolls quicker, which helps us to speed up investigations. The combination of having those as well as the two other positions should help us get to most of those investigations to 90 days.
Senator Johnson.
This doesn't pertain to your budget, Mr. Commissioner. This is just a philosophical question. Jessica made me think of it, so it's really a question for the professional staff.
Okay.
Jessica made the comment that she would like to see the completion rate go from 39 to 78%, and the commissioner's asking for two positions. Does it happen often that you could make them limited positions and see how they had performed in the next biennium?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, it can be done if that is the question that you're asking.
I'm not advocating doing it in this instance. I was just trying to figure out in listening over the course of my three sessions of service here, two and a half, but I count all those special sessions. and listening to agencies come in and make the case for different positions. And we put so much emphasis on performance measures this session. I'm just curious, and this truly doesn't pertain to your budget, but if you condition positions on performance, you make them limited duration to start out with, and if they perform the way that they were expected to perform, then there's an incentive to make them full-time in the next session. And I just didn't know whether or not that was a philosophy that had been ever discussed, and I just don't know about it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, that has, especially when you're phasing in something and you're not real sure about what it's going to do. There are other options that you could look at also, one of which is to direct the agency to track its workload and to report periodically on what is happening with the workload if you approve the packages. You always have the option of eliminating positions as part of a budget cycle if in fact, you want, they are not performing.
Psychologically, I just think it's tougher to do a full-time position than it is a limited duration if you went in knowing that it was a limited duration. And I'm truly not advocating this in this case. It was just the confluence of your policy option package, Jessica's testimony so clearly tied to performance measures, and I don't think either one of you were suggesting this. I just happened to think about it and wanted to ask.
One caution that I would make, and I don't know that that's the case with these positions, but sometimes with highly skilled professional positions, you do run into some recruiting problems.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm not advocating it. I think these are unusually complex positions, for lack of a better word. You're going to invest a lot in getting them trained and up to speed and knowledgeable about a whole variety of subjects. But I think with the heavy emphasis on performance measures and the expectation that if you put these additional investigators in place, that it would move from a performance ratio that's pretty low up higher, and that would be something that you'd want to for sure take a look at next time around. But I'm not advocating making them limited duration.
And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, because it is part of the whole performance process, you might want to think when we get into work session whether or not you want some instruction to have them report to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee on what is happening on this piece of their performance. I just offer that as a suggestion.
Or, Mr. Chair, if I could, or you can certainly make a report to the next legislative session about performance so that the next time our budget does come up, that does become a key focus of let's look at that again.
And you want to be, I think we're all stating it in a very negative way. I think your suggestion would give the opportunity to say to the management of the agency, great job, well done, you did exactly what you said. Mm-hmm. You got the positions, the legislature made an investment, and you delivered. Mm-hmm. And Jessica would be up here saying, this is great. You gave them the positions, well-managed agency. They did good, and everybody's happy. So I see it as much a chance to show off the good management of a solid agency as anything else.
Thank you.
Share with me the rationale as to why public works contractors pay for this fund.
Mr. Chair, if I may, there is in the public works law a requirement that you pay 1%, not less than a certain amount, but not more than $5,000 on public works contracts to ensure compliance with the law, to do education about the law, and that's all set in a different fund that the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee looks at, that the commissioner manages. Contractors are more than willing to pay into that fund, again, because it helps ensure compliance with the law. The vast majority of the contractors out there do the right thing and comply with the law. There are those that make errors because it is a very complicated law with a whole bunch of different wage classifications, and it is, again, errors are, everyone does their best to avoid them, but they happen from time to time, even among the best of the best, just because it is so complicated. But that said, we don't want flagrant violators of the law because we do live in a hard bid industry, which means if you can monkey around with your wages or not pay, folks have a competitive advantage, and we do not support that. So from an industry standpoint, that's why we pay into this fund. Okay. We're comfortable doing that. It's paid for by those that do the work.
Got it.
Okay. I think, Mr. Chair, to put it in a nutshell, it disadvantages honest contractors when there's someone out there that isn't being honest, and that's what we try to do is keep them honest.
Well, the reason I raise that is and I do appreciate that, and that's what I wanted to hear is when I turn back to other pages in the document, seminars, employment, unemployment laws, and handbook sales, and on-site tailored presentations, these are all fees that we're charging to businesses. And I'm just curious if on that ledger sheet we have equal fees to employees.
Mr. Chair, you mean for the prevailing wage fund, or
just? I'm sorry, I'm mixing apples and oranges here. Can I please work with me on that? I just want to make sure, as the Bureau of Labor and Industries is providing service, and we're charging fees, I'm assuming there's a tendency for those fees to be passed on to industry. I'm just curious if there's a balance on that ledger sheet, if you will, for the employment side to also pick up.
Well, Mr. Chair, from a philosophical standpoint, certainly there is. We're 57% general fund, which comes from income taxes, so those individuals...
Paid by business as well.
Paid by business as well. That's true. Really, from this standpoint, from a prevailing wage point of view, these are businesses that are willing to pay for the service that we provide. It also, like I said, pays for the investigators, pays for those seminars that we put on to help businesses. It also pays for the survey that we do across the state to establish the prevailing wage rate in 14 different
regions. I guess I'm just making a blanket statement that I want to make sure that we remember there's two sides to the ledger, and everyone's contributing to the cause, and I just want to make sure it's an equal contribution. So,
in most areas it is, Mr. Chair.
Okay, terrific.
Mr. Chair, if I might also add, Senator Johnson referred to the professional level of the staff, and it's our understanding as industry that the department has had, or the Bureau rather, has had tremendous problem in trying to keep the people in these positions, that there's been a lot of rotation, and it's not, I'm not trying to point the finger at the Bureau and say it's their problem, it's these positions require a great deal of knowledge and are difficult to keep folks in this position, and I'm not sure whether it's a pay scale issue or what it is, but from an industry standpoint, constant turnover is a real issue. When you look at a 90-day, again, 90-day performance benchmark, if you have somebody who constant turnover, you lose the person on the case, the next person comes in, you've got to, you know, I can't, going through, you know, job transition, people have at least a six-week window to figure out what they're doing. This is highly specialized, and again, that drags out this problem even longer. So from that perspective, it would be great to find out whatever the issue is and try and keep these people in this position. Not only is it less of a headache for the Bureau, but from the contractor standpoint, you aren't changing investigators midstream, and somebody who's, you know, fresh as a daisy trying to figure out what is this prevailing wage thing and how do I administer it, and not getting over aggressive because they're new and trying to figure out what the claim is. All meanwhile, our bond's being held and we're trying to work it out. So,
well,
thank you.
And absolutely, Mr. Chair, Jessica is absolutely right. There has been 100% turnover in that unit from the investigators over the last two-year period. Partly, I mean, it's a couple of different issues. One, certainly the pay scale is, you know, on the lower end, there's no doubt. However, it is completely compensatory with our wage and hour and our civil rights investigators. So despite the fact that there is a dedicated fund that could afford to increase that pay scale, I would be very hesitant to do it for fear of starting a mutiny. But between the other investigators, which are general fund dedicated.
But their level of responsibility, training, knowledge, skills, are those equal?
It's a different, if I could, Mr. Chair, it's a different animal. You know, when you're doing a prevailing wage investigation, you're dealing with a lot of mathematical calculations, certified payrolls. It's a very complex mathematical issue. When you're a civil rights investigator, you may be dealing with the issue of trying to decide whether there was or was not discrimination based upon, you know, race, creed, color, age, sex. When you're a wage and hour investigator, you're doing minimum wage investigation. Like, it's really a matter of, as an employee, an interest standpoint. It's more intriguing to do a civil rights investigation than it is to do those complex mathematical formulas of deciding on a particular day whether an individual may be paid iron workers or carpenter scale, which is the type of investigation that you do. It really is that the investigators tend to start in the prevailing wage unit, and when openings come up in civil rights or wage and hour, they find them more interesting.
Thank you.
It's hard to make it fascinating.
Senator Berger.
I am really torn about the low bidder, and while Jessica is up there, I wonder if maybe the two of you could address that. It is going to cost taxpayers a lot of money with the natural gas line, the pipeline, through a mistake. And I'm just curious as to not that specific project, but the responsible bidder plus people who work hard to sharpen their pencil and give you a low bid. So I'm really torn in that area. And yet, where is the statute? What protection do we have in a company that has unlimited lawsuits in their background, have proven to be not competent in their work, and yet they turn in the low bid? And I don't like to throw out all my philosophies about low bids based on that one thing, because there are many companies that work hard all night long and all week long trying to come up with the most frugal bid they can so they can get the job. So can you tell me how do we prevent that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, I'm more than happy to address that issue. There are several things. I would first say that there are occasionally, quite frankly, disasters when it comes to public works contracts. But as Senator Morrison, I can sure attest, having worked on the public works side,
we never had any disasters.
There are hundreds of contractors every day that hold public contracts and millions of dollars of public works construction that occur every year that are done by competent contractors that do an outstanding job. Contractors in your district, Senator Berger, and around the state that with a great deal of integrity, because they are taxpayers too, and eminently qualified, that just do an outstanding job for the state, and I'm proud to represent those folks. And again, Morse Brothers is an outstanding contractor, and they're not a problem child of the industry. There are occasionally disasters, and that's why there are a couple things in the law that enable agencies to protect themselves, in addition to look towards different contracting methods. And we look at the Coos Bay Pipeline, such an enormous project, and granted, low bid is the preferred method of construction. But agencies also, especially when you start talking about large, complex projects, have other options as well. There are methods of construction known as CMGC or design build, and these methods of construction don't rely on the low bid. In fact, they encompass a whole proposal kind of opportunity for an agency to look and say, what else do you bring to the table? What is your experience, and what kind of analysis would you do in this job? It brings the contractor in up front during the design phase and often helps that project be delivered in a more efficient fashion, in addition to sometimes a higher quality depending upon the contractor you select. But because of the different selection method, it forces the agency to take a closer look at the qualifications of the contractor instead of just the price. In fact, you tend to get to the price as a later factor in the decision making, and it is only one of many. Often half or less than half of the decision making is set on price. It tends to more be on the qualifications of the contractor. So that's one area, and that has to do with selection method. But if you choose to do low bid, which again, AGC prefers that agencies choose low bid, because for the vast majority of the contracts, it makes the most sense. You still, as an agency, have plenty of opportunity to either, in the interest of the public as a whole, which is a very broad standard and not something that you have to, is not a high threshold to meet, you can reject a bid if you have concerns. and you're supposed to be doing a responsible bidder determination. The public contracting law requires that before a contract is awarded, that a public agency determines whether a bidder is responsible, whether they have a satisfactory record of performance and a satisfactory record of integrity. And as we've discussed in the Senate General Government Committee, one of the problems with that law is that it's not as specific as it could be in helping agencies really understand how to do that. Part of our recommendation is that this legislature direct the Department of Justice, together with stakeholders that understands the ins and the outs of this industry, to try and provide some guidance to agencies in what specifically does it mean to have a satisfactory record of performance, to have a satisfactory record of integrity, so that agencies have some standards by which they can choose to accept or reject a bid based upon the qualifications of the contractor, not just on price, even in a low bid scenario. So we encourage agencies to make those determinations, but again, I think part of the problem with the law is that it isn't as clear as it could be. I apologize for such a long explanation, but it really is a complicated issue.
I appreciate that explanation, Jessica, because of course, having experienced and watched the disaster, I think that that's well taken. Is there legislation pending on the change?
Chair Smith, Senator Verger, Senate Bill 1006, which is on its way to the House. I think there are further discussions that will occur on that legislation about it is related to the responsible bidder statute. AGC has significant concerns about the bill as it is drafted today because we don't believe it gets at the issue that I just laid out, which is that we need to get together and make it more specific. It creates a form that we don't believe actually gets to the issue that you've raised. So I believe there are ongoing conversations among the construction industry lobby about how to best address that issue. But as that bill heads over here, that's an ongoing conversation.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Richard, for my part, I mean, there is a big difference between the lowest bidder and the lowest responsible bidder, as clearly the Coos Bay Pipeline Project can point out. And I think anything that we can do to help to better define what responsible is and where we can help to collect more information so that, you know, a local government such as, you know, the City Council of Coos Bay or the County Board of Commissioners of Coos County, when they're doing a project, can gather information. You know, you can get some from different repositories like the Construction Contractors Board and others, but if you collect all that information together to be able to look at it in totality for any problems with a contractor, it can help you to understand better and make that decision.
Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, but there is no blacklist. In other words, there's not a list of people that just because of the kind of work that they've done in the past and the number of lawsuits and all, just simply get on a blacklist.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, there is, if you want to refer to it as a blacklist, the Bureau of Labor and Industries for violations of the prevailing wage law, we can, issue an order that says that you cannot bid on a public works project as a contractor for a three-year period if, in fact, you've had multiple violations of the prevailing wage law. But it's limited to the prevailing wage law.
Uh-huh. Actually, Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, there's also a similar list at the CCB for failure to pay your subcontractors. You can also be disbarred for other acts as well, including failure to and improper substitution of your subcontractors on a subcontractor disclosure form. So there are ways to disqualify contractors, but if an agency walks down that road, they need to be prepared for a lawsuit, because for many of these contractors that act in the public works marketplace, it is their livelihood. So it violations need to be very serious before an agency takes that action, and we think, quite frankly, the violations need to be very, very serious before an agency takes this action.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would echo Jessica's concern over Senate Bill 1006. I think it takes Boley in a direction that's far beyond what is ever intended within the scope of Boley. Because if you read the pre-qualifications that are in existing statutes, in terms of qualifying bidders, responsible bidders. It puts Boley in a superior position to ports, to ODOT, to cities, counties, any public agency with respect to qualifying bidders. And I'm not sure that that's the direction that we ought to be going with your agency. And I have some very grave concerns over that bill. I think it's not the right solution to the issue at hand, and I'm not sure that the issue has adequately been characterized and defined, at least in the Senate, as we were, you know, potentially processing that bill today, because my discussion with my colleagues, they didn't have a clue what that bill was or what it meant or what the problem was. And so I've just got some real concerns about that bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, first let me point out it's not my bill. I think whatever we can do as agencies, whether it's Construction Contractors Board or Boley or OSHA or Workers' Comp, whatever we can do to help provide more adequate information and be able to give those, if we're talking about the City Council of Coos Bay or Coos County or you name the county or the city, better information to decide on a responsible contractor. I think that the more we can consolidate that information and be able to provide it, the better.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Follow-up. Whose bill is it?
Actually, the bill is right here. It's for the. It's a committee bill for the Committee on Rules, and it's introduced by the Oregon Construction and Building Trades, not by me.
Jared can own up to it.
We'll be happy to go and talk about it. If
you want. Well, we need to talk about it. I think
doesn't
it's a
sound
bad
like
bill.
Much to talk about.
You might as well make a lot of appointments.
I'll pull out the couch for you.
All right. Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I'd just say from a public policy position, whatever, from a policy standpoint, the legislature decides Boley should do will be perfectly adequate at doing it.
Forever the politician.
Works so far, I don't know.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, of course. Where do we want to go next?
Mr. Chair, just for the record again, Annette Talbot, Deputy Labor Commissioner. I don't know if you were aware that this we would like a technical adjustment when it comes to the work session time, because we're adding two positions to this prevailing wage workload dilemma that we're under. We had another policy package option under apprenticeship that would have had a prevailing wage position for assisting us in addressing the workforce shortages and apprenticeship issues, and we have asked both the budget and management and LFO to move that so that we actually devote two positions to prevailing wage so that we're assured we can actually attack that workload and get it under control. So just so that that's on the record, that you know that it looks different than the governor's budget as proposed. The number of positions doesn't change. It's just what their duties would do.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Then, Annette, once the problem was, as you say, attacked and fixed, then would those people be cross-trained to do other responsibilities, or is this going to be an ongoing issue?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, that's a good question. I think that the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division would tell you that this might be an ongoing workload that needs to be continue those positions at the PWR investigation stage so that we can keep the time that was talked about by Jessica down to a minimum. But clearly we would be more than willing to report back to this committee or another committee to see how that goes.
Well, you've got a whole chorus of heads behind you.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, since that is a dedicated fund, it has to be, the duties have to be dedicated toward prevailing wage. If we were to convert them over to Wage and Hour Civil Rights, we'd have a statutory problem.
Okay. Colleagues, what I'm going to do is help us get out of here a little bit early. Some of us have the pleasure of driving over to Tillamook County.
Yay.
And so it's lovely, we are hosting a public hearing today. What I am going to ask is I have a few questions. If you could be
if you could just get me written responses.
Sure.
On the private employment agencies, if you could let me know what function you folks still play there in terms of personnel cost. And then where I'm going with this, just to be upfront with you, is I understand, I think it was Consumer and Business Services also has a collection oversight component. And I just need to know the difference between the two and how you folks function versus what they do. Mm-hmm. So I can be clear on that. Another issue is I'm reading in trends and issues under wage and hour division, a statement that talks about $1.7 million in unpaid wages for workers was collected, and I just need to understand that. Okay.
Sure.
Again,
through the Wage Security Fund, is that the reference?
Yeah, I'm sorry, it's on page. Where am I? I'm in wage and hour division.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Just to make sure we answer your specific question.
Yeah. Those are my two. I don't know if the committee would have any other questions. No.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I was going to suggest that tomorrow we start off with the DAS overview of the governor's budget, and then follow up with the performance measure issue that we were discussing earlier. And then we also have public testimony scheduled.
Perfect, perfect. Any other, Senator Morris?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I point this out as something that
yes.
that I think is something that we ought not to overlook. It's pretty systematic throughout the budget. If you take the pension cost and flexible benefit costs, they represent 43.6% of the salary cost. And that's a showstopper mm-hmm. in the private sector. But I think it's something that we need to be cognizant of in these budgets.
Mr.
Senator Carter.
That's because it's a labor-intensive industry. They don't have objects to deal with a lot. It's people. And anytime you have a labor-intensive industry, I'm sure the senator knows that, but just a reminder to us all, when you have a labor-intensive industry, you're going to have high incidences of cost, PERS, health care, other things to come up with it along with salary.
Well, I think that's something we'll just flush through.
Right.
Between now and
right.
round three. Senator Johnson.
We dealt with the same question this morning posed by Senator Morris in another committee, but that is what the schedule for this agency looks like. We're going to take the BAM overview tomorrow, public testimony. Are we scheduled for work session?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson.
Okay. And then we'll, tomorrow's Thursday, then will we come back Monday with Bureau of Labor and Industries?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we will start on DCBS on Monday. Economic and Community Development Department on Monday. We also have a Department of Transportation grant that we will need to deal with first up.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other thoughts or comments from the committee? Just really quick, Mr. Commissioner, Jared was sharing this joke with me, and I didn't get it, and I thought perhaps you could help me. And the committee's heard this before, but he was telling me, what's the difference?
I need to go.
How does this go, Jared? A plumber who fails out of trade school becomes what?
Sounds like something Gary Representative Hansen would come up
with. I can't remember.
Just a hint, it's not an elective statewide office.
Mr. Chair, the one thing I would suggest that you ask him is what are the three things you need to know to be a plumber? So.
I'm very familiar with that. With that, colleagues, we're going to be adjourned for the day.